Who are you, Mr. Torrance?
Dan let go of Chetta's hands and took Lucy's. Walk with me. Not far. Just across the room. She stood up without protest, still looking into his face. He led her to the bathroom door, which was standing open. He turned on the light and pointed to the mirror above the wash basin, where they were framed as if in a photograph. Seen that way, there could be little doubt. None, really. He said, "My father was your father, Lucy. I'm your half-brother." 7. After notifying the head nurse that there had been a death on the floor, they went to the hospital's small non-denominational chapel. Lucy knew the way. Although not much of a believer, she had spent a good many hours there, thinking and remembering. It was a comforting place to do those things, which are necessary when a loved one nears the end. At this hour, they had it all to themselves. "First things first," Dan said. "I have to ask if you believe me. We can do the DNA test when there's time, but do we need to?" Lucy shook her head dazedly, never taking her eyes from his face. She seemed to be trying to memorize it. "Dear Jesus, I can hardly get my breath."
"I thought you looked familiar the first time I saw you," Dave said to Dan. "Now I know why. I would have gotten it sooner, I think, if it hadn't been, you know."
"So right in front of you," John said. "Dan, does Abra know?"
"Sure,"
Dan smiled, remembering Abra's theory of relativity.
"She got it from your mind?" Lucy asked. "Using her telepathy thing?"
"No, because I didn't know. Even someone as talented as Abra can't read something that isn't there. But on a deeper level, we both knew. Hell, we even said it out loud. If anyone asked what we were doing together, we were going to say I was her uncle, which I am. I should have realized consciously sooner than I did."
"This is coincidence beyond coincidence," Dave said, shaking his head.
"It's not. It's the farthest thing in the world from coincidence. Lucy, I understand that you're confused and angry. I'll tell you everything I know, but it will take some time. Thanks to John and your husband and Abra, her most of all, we've got some."
"On the way," Lucy said. "You can tell me on the way to Abra."
"All right," Dan said. "On the way. But 3 hours sleep first." She was shaking her head before he finished.
"No, now. I have to see her as soon as I possibly can. Don't you understand? She's my daughter. She's been kidnapped, and I have to see her."
"She's been kidnapped, but now she's safe," Dan said.
"You say that, of course you do, but you don't know."
"Abra says it," he replied. "And she does know. Listen, Mrs. Stone. Lucy, she's asleep right now, and she needs her sleep. I do too. I've got a long trip ahead of me, and I think it's going to be a hard one. Very hard."
Lucy was looking at him closely. "Are you all right?"
"Just tired."
"We all are," John said. "It's been a stressful day."
He uttered a brief yap of laughter, then pressed both hands over his mouth like a child who said a naughty word.
"I can't even call her and hear her voice," Lucy said. She spoke slowly, as if trying to articulate a difficult precept. "Because they're sleeping off the drugs this man, the one you say she calls the Crow, put into her."
"Soon," Dave said. "You'll see her soon."
He put his hand over hers.
For a moment, Lucy looked as if she would shake it off. She clasped it instead. "I can start on the way back to your grandmother's," Dan said. He got up. It was an effort. "Come on." 8. He had time to tell her how a lost man had ridden a northbound bus out of Massachusetts, and how, just over the New Hampshire state line, he'd tossed what would turn out to be his last bottle of booze into a trash can with, "If you no longer need it, leave it here," stenciled on the side. He told them how his childhood friend Tony had spoken up for the first time in years when the bus had rolled into Fraser. "This is the place," Tony had said. From there, he doubled back to a time when he had been Danny instead of Dan, and sometimes Doc, as in "What's Up, Doc," and his invisible friend Tony had been an absolute necessity. The Shining was only one of the burdens that Tony helped him bear, and not the major one. The major one was his alcoholic father, a troubled and ultimately dangerous man whom both Danny and his mother had loved deeply, perhaps as much because of his flaws as in spite of them. He had a terrible temper, and you didn't have to be a telepath to know when it was getting the best of him. For one thing, he was usually drunk when it happened. I know he was loaded on the night he caught me in his study, messing with his papers. He broke my arm. "How old were you?" Dave asked. He was riding in the back seat with his wife. 4, I think. Maybe even younger. When he was on the warpath, he had this habit of rubbing his mouth," Danny demonstrated. "Do you know anyone else who does that when she's upset?"
"Apra," Lucy said. "I thought she got it from me." She raised her right hand toward her mouth, then captured it with her left and returned it to her lap.
Dan had seen Abra do exactly the same thing on the bench outside the Aniston Public Library on the day they'd met in person for the first time.
"I thought she got her temper from me, too. I can be pretty ragged sometimes."
"I thought of my father the first time I saw her do the mouth-rubbing thing," Dan said. "But I had other things on my mind, so I forgot."
This made him think of Watson, the caretaker at the Overlook, who had first shown the hotel's untrustworthy furnace boiler to his father.
"You have to watch it," Watson had said, "because she creeps."
But in the end, Jack Torrance had forgotten. It was the reason Dan was still alive.
"Are you telling me you figured out this family relationship from one little habit?"
"That's quite a deductive leap, especially when it's you and I who look alike, not you and Abra. She gets most of her looks from her father."
Lucy paused, thinking. "But of course you share another family trait. Dave says you call it the Shining. That's how you knew, isn't it?"
Dan shook his head. "I made a friend the year my father died. His name was Dick Halloran, and he was the cook at the Overlook Hotel. He also had the Shining, and he told me lots of people had a little bit of it. He was right. I've met plenty of people along the way who shine to a greater or lesser degree. Billy Freeman, for one, which is why he's with Abra right now." John swung the Suburban into the little parking area behind Conchetta's condo, but for the time being, none of them got out. In spite of her worry about her daughter, Lucy was fascinated by this history lesson. Dan didn't have to look at her to know it.
"If it wasn't the Shining, what was it?"
"When we were going out to Cloud Gap on the Riv, Dave mentioned that you found a trunk in storage at Conchetta's building."
"Yes, my mother's. I had no idea Momo had saved some of her things."
"Dave told John and me that she was quite the party girl back in the day." It was actually Abra that Dave had been talking to via telepathic link, but this was something Dan felt it might be better for his newly discovered half-sister not to know, at least for the time being. Lucy flashed Dave the reproachful look reserved for spouses who have been telling tales out of school, but said nothing. "He also said that when Alessandra dropped out of SUNY Albany, she was doing her student teaching at a prep school in Vermont or Massachusetts. My father taught English, until he lost his job for hurting a student, that is, in Vermont, at a school called Stovington Prep. And according to my mother, he was quite the party boy in those days. Once I knew that Abra and Billy were safe, I ran some numbers in my head. They seemed to add up, but I felt if anyone knew for sure, it would be Alessandra Anderson's mother.
Did she?
Lucy asked. She was leaning forward now, her hands on the console between the front seats. Not everything, and we didn't have long together, but she knew enough. She didn't remember the name of the school where your mother's student taught, but she knew it was in Vermont. And that she'd had a brief affair with her supervising teacher, who was, she said, a published writer. Dan paused. My father was a published writer. Only a few stories, but some of them were in very good magazines like the Atlantic Monthly. Conchetta never asked her for the man's name, and Alessandra never volunteered it, but if her college transcript is in that trunk, I'm pretty sure you'll find that her supervisor was John Edward Torrance. He yawned and looked at his watch. That's all I can do right now. Let's go upstairs. 3 hours sleep for all of us, then on to upstate New York. The roads will be empty, and we should be able to make great time.
Do you swear she's safe? Lucy asked.
Dan nodded.
All right, I'll wait, but only for 3 hours.
As for sleeping, she laughed. The sound had no humor in it. 9. When they entered Conchetta's condo, Lucy strode directly to the microwave in the kitchen, set the timer, and showed it to Dan. He nodded, then yawned again.
3:30 a.m., we're out of here.
She studied him gravely.
I'd like to go without you, you know. Right this minute.
He smiled a little. I think you better hear the rest of the story first. She nodded grimly.
That and the fact that my daughter needs to sleep off whatever is in her system are the only things holding me here. Now go lie down before you fall down.
Dan and John took the guest room. The wallpaper and furnishings made it clear that it had been mostly kept for one special little girl. But Chetta must have had other guests from time to time, because there were twin beds. As they lay in the dark, John said,
It's not a coincidence that this hotel you stayed in as a child is also in Colorado, is it?
No. This true knot is in the same town?
They are.
And the hotel was haunted.
The ghosty people, Dan thought.
Yes. Then John said something that surprised Dan and temporarily brought him back from the edge of sleep. Dave had been right. The easiest things to miss were the ones right in front of you.
It makes sense, I suppose. Once you accept the idea, there could be supernatural beings among us and feeding on us. An evil place would call evil creatures. They'd feel right at home there. Do you suppose this knot has other places like that? In other parts of the country? Other, I don't know, cold spots?
I'm sure they do. Dan put an arm over his eyes. His body ached and his head was pounding. Johnny, I'd love to do the boys having a sleepover thing with you, but I have to get some shut-eye.
Okay, but...
John got up on one elbow.
All things being equal, you would have gone right from the hospital like Lucy wanted, because you care almost as much about Abra as they do. You think she's safe, but you could be wrong.
I'm not. Hoping that was the truth. He had to hope so, because the simple fact was that he couldn't go, not now. If it had only been to New York, maybe, but it wasn't, and he had to sleep. His whole body cried for it.
What's wrong with you, Dan? Because you look terrible.
Nothing. Just tired. Then he was gone. First into darkness, and then into a confused nightmare of running down endless halls while some shape followed him, swinging a mallet from side to side, splitting wallpaper, and driving up puffs of plaster dust.
Come out, you little shit! The shape yelled. Come out, you worthless pup! And take your medicine!
Then Abra was with him. They were sitting on the bench in front of the Anniston Public Library, in the late summer sun. She was holding his hand.
It's all right, Uncle Dan. It's all right. Before he died, Your father turned that shape out. You don't have to.
The library door banged open, and a woman stepped into the sunlight. Great clouds of dark hair billowed around her head, yet her jauntily cocked top hat stayed on. It stayed on like magic.
"Oh, look," she said. "It's Dan Torrance, the man who stole a woman's money while she was sleeping one off, and then left her kid to be beaten to death."
She smiled at Abra, revealing a single tooth. It looked as long and sharp as a bayonet.
"What will he do to you, little sweetie? What will he do to you?"
10. Lucy woke him promptly at 3:30, but shook her head when Dan moved to wake John.
"Let him sleep a bit longer, and my husband is snoring on the couch." She actually smiled. "It makes me think of the Garden of Gethsemane, you know? Jesus reproaching Peter, saying, 'So you could not watch with me even 1 hour?' Or something like that. But I have no reason to reproach David, I guess. He saw it too. Come on, I've made scrambled eggs. You look like you could use some. You're skinny as a rail." She paused and added, "Brother?" Dan wasn't particularly hungry, but he followed her into the kitchen. "Saw what to?" "I was going through Momo's papers. Anything to keep my hands busy and pass the time. And I heard a clunk from the kitchen."
She took his hand and led him to the counter between the stove and the fridge. There was a row of old-fashioned apothecary jars here, and the one containing sugar had been overturned. A message had been written in the spill.
"I'm okay. Going back to sleep. Love you. Smiley face."
In spite of how he felt, Dan thought of his blackboard and had to smile. It was so perfectly Abra.
"She must have woken up just enough to do that," Lucy said.
"Don't think so," Dan said. She looked at him from the stove where she was dishing up scrambled eggs. "You woke her up. She heard your worry."
"Do you really believe that?"
"Yes."
"Sit down." She paused. "Sit down, Dan. I guess I better get used to calling you that. Sit down and eat."
Dan wasn't hungry, but he needed the fuel. He did as she said. 11. She sat across from him, sipping a glass of juice from the last carafe Conchetta Reynolds would ever have delivered from Dean and DeLuca.
"Older man with booze issues, star-struck younger woman. That's the picture I'm getting."
"It's the one I got, too." Dan shoveled the eggs in steadily and methodically, not tasting them.
"Coffee, mister? Dan?"
"Please." She went past the spilled sugar to the bun.
"He's married, but his job takes him to a lot of faculty parties where there are a lot of pretty young gals, not to mention a fair amount of blooming libido when the hour gets late and the music gets loud."
"Sounds about right," Dan said. "Maybe my mom used to go along to those parties, but then there was a kid to take care of at home and no money for babysitters." She passed him a cup of coffee. He sipped it black before she could ask what he took in it. "Thanks. Anyway, they had a thing. Probably at one of the local motels. It sure wasn't in the back of his car. We had a VW Bug. Even a couple of horny acrobats couldn't have managed that."
"Blackout screwing," John said, coming into the room. His hair was standing up in sleep quills at the back of his head. "That's what the old-timers call it. Are there any more of those eggs?"
"Plenty," Lucy said. "Abra left a message on the counter."
"Really?" John went to look at it. "That was her?"
"Yes, I'd know her printing anywhere."
"Holy shit. This could put Verizon out of business."
She didn't smile.
"Sit down and eat, John. You've got 10 minutes, then I'm going to wake up Sleeping Beauty in there on the couch."
She sat down.
"Go on, Dan."
"I don't know if she thought my dad would leave my mom for her or not, and I doubt if you'll find the answer to that one in her trunk. unless maybe she left a diary. All I know, based on what Dave said and what Conchetta told me later, is that she hung around for a while. Maybe hoping, maybe just partying, maybe both. But by the time she found out she was pregnant, she must have given up. For all I know, we might have been in Colorado by then.
Do you suppose your mother ever found out?
I don't know. But she must have wondered how faithful he was, especially on the nights when he came in late and shit-faced. And I'm sure she knew that drunks don't limit their bad behavior to betting the ponies or tucking five spots into the cleavage of the waitress down at the Twist and Shout.
She put a hand on his arm. Are you all right? You look exhausted.
I'm okay. But you're not the only one who's trying to process all this.
She died in a car accident, Lucy said. She had turned from Dan and was looking fixedly at the bulletin board on the fridge. In the middle was a photograph of Conchetta and Abra, who looked about four, walking hand in hand through a field of daisies. The man with her was a lot older, and drunk. They were going fast. Momo didn't want to tell me, but around the time I turned 18 I got curious and nagged her into giving me at least some of the details. When I asked if my mother was drunk too, Chetta said she didn't know. She said the police have no reason to test passengers who are killed in fatal accidents. Only the driver. She sighed. It doesn't matter. We'll leave the family stories for another day. Tell me what's happened to my daughter.
He did. At some point, he turned around and saw Dave Stone standing in the doorway, tucking his shirt into his pants and watching him. 12. Dan started with how Abra had gotten in touch with him, first using Tony as a kind of intermediary. Then how Abra had come in contact with the True Knot, a nightmare vision of the one she called the baseball boy.
I remember that nightmare, Lucy said. She woke me up screaming. It had happened before, but it was the first time in 2 or 3 years.
Dave frowned. I don't remember that at all.
You were in Boston at a conference. She turned to Dan. Let me see if I've got this. These people aren't people. They're... what? Some kind of vampires?
In a way, I suppose. They don't sleep in coffins during the day or turn into bats by moonlight, and I doubt if crosses and garlic bother them, but they're parasites, and they're certainly not human.
Human beings don't disappear when they die, John said flatly.
You really saw that happen?
We did. All three of us.
In any case, Dan said, the True Knot isn't interested in ordinary children, only those who have the shining.
Children like Abra, Lucy said.
Yes, they torture them before killing them.
To purify the steam, Abra says.
I keep picturing moonshiners making white lightning.
They want to inhale her, Lucy said, still trying to get it straight in her head, because she has the shining.
Not just the shining, but a great shining. I'm a flashlight. She's a lighthouse. And she knows about them. She knows what they are.
There's more, John said. What we did to those men at Cloud Gap. As far as this rose is concerned, that's down to Abra, no matter who actually did the killing.
What else could she expect? Lucy asked indignantly. Don't they understand self-defense? Survival?
What Rose understands, Dan said, is that there's a little girl who has challenged her.
Challenged?
Abra got in touch telepathically. She told Rose that she was coming after her.
She what?
That temper of hers, Dave said quietly.
I've told her 100 times it would get her in trouble.
She's not going anywhere near that woman. Or her child-killing friends, Lucy said.
Dan thought, yes and no. He took Lucy's hand. She started to pull away, then didn't.
The thing you have to understand is really quite simple, he said. They will never stop.
But...
No buts, Lucy. Under other circumstances, Rose still might have decided to disengage. This is one crafty old she-wolf. But there's one other factor.
Which is?
They're sick, John said. Abra says it's the measles. They might even have caught it from the Trevor boy. I don't know if you'd call that divine retribution or just irony.
Measles?
I know it doesn't sound like much, but believe me, it is. You know how, in the old days, measles could run through a whole family of kids. If that's happening to this true knot, it could wipe them out.
Good, Lucy cried. The angry smile on her face was one Dan knew well.
Not if they think Abra's super steam will cure them, Dave said. That's what you need to understand, hun. This isn't just a skirmish. To this bitch, it's a fight to the death.
He struggled and then brought out the rest of it because it had to be said.
If Rose gets the chance, she'll eat our daughter alive.
13. Lucy asked, where are they? This true knot, where are they?
Colorado, Dan said, at a place called the Bluebell Campground in the town of Sidewinder. That the site of the campground was the very place where he had once almost died at his father's hands was a thing he didn't want to say, because it would lead to more questions and more cries of coincidence. The one thing of which Dan was sure was that there were no coincidences.
This Sidewinder must have a police department, Lucy said. We'll call them and get them on this.
By telling them what? John's tone was gentle, non-argumentative.
Well, that...
If you actually got the cops to go up there to the campground, Dan said, they'd find nothing but a bunch of middle-aged going-on-older Americans. Harmless RV folks, the kind who always want to show you pictures of their grandkids. Their papers would all be in apple pie order, from dog licenses to land deeds. The police wouldn't find guns if they managed to get a search warrant, which they wouldn't, no probable cause, because the true knot doesn't need guns. Their weapons are up here. Dan tapped his forehead. You'd be the crazy lady from New Hampshire. Abra would be your crazy daughter who ran away from home, and we'd be your crazy friends. Lucy pressed her palms to her temples.
I can't believe this is happening.
If you did a search of records, I think you'd find that the True Knot, under whatever name they might be incorporated, has been very generous to that particular Colorado town. You don't shit in your nest, you feather it. Then if bad times come, you have lots of friends.
These bastards have been around a long time, John said, haven't they? Because the main thing they take from this steam is longevity.
I'm pretty sure that's right, Dan said. And as good Americans, I'm sure they've been busy making money the whole time. Enough to grease wheels a lot bigger than the ones that turn in Sidewinder. State wheels. Federal wheels.
And this Rose, she'll never stop.
No. Dan was thinking of the precognitive vision he'd had of her. The cocked hat. The yawning mouth. The single tooth. Her heart is set on your daughter.
A woman who stays alive by killing children has no heart, Dave said.
Oh, she has one, Dan said, but it's black.
Lucy stood up. No more talking. I want to go to her now. Everybody use the bathroom, because once we leave, we're not stopping until we get to that motel.
Dan said, does Conchetta have a computer? If she does, I need to take a quick peek at something before we go.
Lucy sighed. It's in her study, and I think you can guess the password. But if you take more than 5 minutes, we're going without you.
14. Rose lay awake in her bed, stiff as a poker, trembling with steam and fury. When an engine started up at 2:15, she heard it. Steamhead Steve and Baba the Russian. When another started at 4:20, she heard that one too. This time,
It was the little twins, P and Pod.
Sweet Terry Pickford was with them, no doubt looking nervously through the back window for any sign of Rose. Big Mo had asked to go along, begged to go along, but they had turned her down because Mo was carrying the disease. Rose could have stopped them, but why bother? Let them discover what life was like in America on their own, with no true knot to protect them in camp or watch their backs while they were on the road. Especially when I tell Toadie Slim to kill their credit cards and empty their rich bank accounts, she thought. Toadie was no Jimmy Numbers, but he could still take care of it, and at the touch of a button, and he'd be there to do it. Toadie would stick. So would all the good ones. Or almost all the good ones. Dirty Phil, Apron Annie, and Diesel Doug were no longer on their way back. They had taken a vote and decided to head south instead. Dees had told them Rose was no longer to be trusted, and besides, it was long past time to cut the knot. Good luck with that, darling boy, she thought, clinching and unclinching her fists. Splitting the true was a terrible idea, but thinning the herd was a good one. So let the weaklings run and the sicklings die. When the bitch girl was also dead and they had swallowed her steam, Rose had no more illusions of keeping her prisoner. The 25 or so who were left would be stronger than ever. She mourned Crow, and she knew she had no one who could step into his shoes. But Token Charlie would do the best he could. So would Harpman Sam, Bent Dick, Fat Fanny, and Long Paul. Greedy G, not the brightest bulb, but loyal and unquestioning. Besides, with the others gone, the steam she still had in storage would go farther and make them stronger. They would need to be strong. Come to me, little bitch girl, Rose thought. See how strong you are when there are 24 against you. See how you like it when it's just you against the true. We'll eat your steam and lap up your blood. But first, we'll drink your screams. Rose stared up into the darkness, hearing the fading voices of the runners, the faithless ones. At the door came a soft, timid knock. Rose lay silent for a moment or two, considering, then swung her legs out of bed. Come. She was naked, but made no attempt to cover herself when silent Sayri crept in, shapeless inside one of her flannel nightgowns, her mouse-colored bangs covering her brows and almost hanging in her eyes. As always, Sayri seemed hardly there, even when she was.
I'm sad, Los.
I know you are. I'm sad, too. She wasn't. She was furious, but it sounded good.
I miss Andy.
Andy, yes. Rube name Andrea Steiner, whose father had fucked the humanity out of her long before the true knot had found her. Rose remembered watching her that day in the movie theater, and how later she had fought her way through the turning with sheer guts and willpower. Snakebite Andy would have stuck. Snake would have walked through fire if Rose said the true knot needed her to. She held out her arms. Sayri scurried to her and laid her head against Rose's breast.
Without her, I want to die.
No, honey, I don't think so. Rose pulled the little thing into bed and hugged her tight. She was nothing but a rack of bones held together by scant meat. Tell me what you really want. Beneath the shaggy bangs, two eyes gleamed, feral.
Lavenge.
Rose kissed one cheek, then the other, then the thin, dry lips. She drew back a little and said, Yes, and you'll have it. Open your mouth, Sayri. Sayri obediently did so. Their lips came together again. Rose the Hat, still full of steam, breathed down silent Sayri's throat. 15. The walls of Conchetta's study were papered with memos, fragments of poems, and correspondence that would never be answered. Dan typed in the four-letter password, launched Firefox, and Googled the Bluebell Campground. They had a website that wasn't terribly informative, probably because the owners didn't care that much about attracting visitors. The place was your basic front. But there were photos of the property, and these Dan studied with the fascination people reserve for recently discovered old family albums. The overlook was long gone, but he recognized the terrain. Once, just before the first of the snowstorms that closed them in for the winter, he and his mother and father had stood together on the hotel's broad front porch, seeming even broader with the lawn gliders and wicker furniture and storage, looking down the long, smooth slope of the front lawn. At the bottom, where the deer and the antelope often came out to play, there was now a long, rustic building called the Overlook Lodge. Here, the caption said, visitors could dine, play bingo, and dance to live music on Friday and Saturday nights. On Sundays, there were church services, overseen by a rotating cadre of sidewinders, men and women of the cloth. Until the snow came, my father mowed that lawn and trimmed the topiary that used to be there. He said he'd trimmed lots of ladies' topiaries in his time. I didn't get the joke, but it used to make Mom laugh. Some joke, he said low. He saw rows of sparkling RV hookups, Lux Mod Cons that supplied LP gas as well as electricity. There were men's and women's shower buildings big enough to service mega truck stops like Little America or Pedro south of the border. There was a playground for the wee folks. Dan wondered if the kiddies who played there ever saw or sensed unsettling things, as Danny Doc Torrance once had in the Overlook's playground. There was a softball field, a shuffleboard area, a couple of tennis courts, even bocce. No Roke, though. Not that. Not anymore. Halfway up the slope, where the Overlook's hedge animals had once congregated, there was a row of clean white satellite dishes. At the crest of the hill, where the hotel itself had stood, was a wooden platform with a long flight of steps leading up to it. This site, now owned and administered by the state of Colorado, was identified as Roof of the World. Visitors to the Bluebell Campground were welcome to use it or to hike the trails beyond free of charge.
The trails are recommended only for the more experienced hiker, the caption read, but Roof of the World is for everyone.
The views are spectacular. Dan was sure they were. Certainly they had been spectacular from the dining room and ballroom of the Overlook, at least until the steadily mounting snow blocked off the windows. To the west were the highest peaks of the Rocky Mountains, sawing at the sky like spears. To the east, you could see all the way to Boulder. Hell, all the way to Denver and Arvada on rare days when the pollution wasn't too bad. The state had taken that particular piece of land, and Dan wasn't surprised. Who would have wanted to build there? The ground was rotten, and he doubted if you had to be telepathic to sense it. But the True had gotten as close as it could, and Dan had an idea that their wandering guests, the normal ones, rarely came back for a second visit or recommended the Bluebell to their friends.
An evil place would call evil creatures, John had said.
If so, the converse would also be true. It would tend to repel good ones.
Dan, Dave called, bus is leaving.
I need another minute. He closed his eyes and propped the heel of his palm against his forehead. Abra. His voice awoke her at once. Chapter 17. Bitch Girl. 1. It was dark outside the Crown Motel, dawn still an hour or more away, when the door of Unit 24 opened and a girl stepped out. Heavy fog had moved in, and the world was hardly there at all. The girl was wearing black pants and a white shirt. She had put her hair up in pigtails, and the face they framed looked very young. She breathed deeply, the coolness and the hanging moisture in the air doing wonders for her lingering headache, but not much for her unhappy heart. Momo was dead. Yet if Uncle Dan was right, not really dead, just somewhere else. Perhaps a ghosty person, perhaps not. In any case, it wasn't a thing she could spend time thinking about. Later, perhaps, she would meditate on these matters. Dan had asked if Billy was asleep. Yes, she had told him, still fast asleep. Through the open door, she could see Mr. Freeman's feet and legs under the blankets and hear his steady snoring. He sounded like an idling motorboat. Dan had asked if Rose or any of the others had tried to touch her mind. No, she would have known. Her traps were set. Rose would guess that. She wasn't stupid. He had asked if there was a telephone in her room. Yes, there was a phone. Uncle Dan told her what he wanted her to do. It was pretty simple. The scary part was what she had to say to that strange woman in Colorado. And yet, she wanted to. Part of her had wanted that ever since she'd heard the baseball boy's dying screams. You understand the words you have to keep saying? Yes, of course. Because you have to goad her. Do you know what that... Yes, I know what it means. Make her mad. Infuriate her. Abra stood breathing into the fog. The road they'd driven in on was nothing but a scratch. The trees on the other side completely gone. So was the motel office. Sometimes she wished she was like that. All white on the inside. But only sometimes. In her deepest heart, she had never regretted what she was. When she felt ready as she could be, Abra went back into her room and closed the door on her side so she wouldn't disturb Mr. Freeman if she had to talk loud. She examined the instructions on the phone, pushed 9 to get an outside line, then dialed directory assistance and asked for the number of the Overlook Lodge at the Bluebell Campground in Sidewinder, Colorado. I could give you the main number, Dan had said, but you'd only get an answering machine. In the place where the guests ate meals and played games, the telephone rang for a long time. Dan said it probably would, and that she should just wait it out. It was, after all, 2 hours earlier there. At last a grumpy voice said, "Hello? If you want the office, you called the wrong num-"
"I don't want the office," Abra said.
She hoped the rapid, heavy beating of her heart wasn't audible in her voice.
"I want Rose. Rose the Hat."
A pause, then, "Who is this?"
"Abra Stone. You know my name, don't you? I'm the girl she's looking for. Tell her I'll call back in 5 minutes. If she's there, we'll talk. If she's not, tell her she can go fuck herself. I won't call back again."
Abra hung up, then lowered her head, cupped her burning face in her palms, and took long, deep breaths. 2. Rose was drinking coffee behind the wheel of her Earth cruiser, her feet on the secret compartment with the stored canisters of steam inside, when the knock came at her door. A knock this early could only mean more trouble. "Yes," she said, "come in." It was Long Paul, wearing a robe over childish pajamas with racing cars on them.
"The payphone in the lodge started ringing. At first I let it go, thought it was a wrong number, and besides, I was making coffee in the kitchen, but it kept on, so I answered. It was that girl. She wanted to talk to you. She said she'd call back in 5 minutes."
Silent Sairi sat up in bed, blinking through her bangs, the covers clutched around her shoulders like a shawl.
"Go,"
Rose told her. Sairi did so without a word. Rose watched through the Earth Cruiser's wide windshield as Sari trudged barefooted back to the bounder she had shared with Snake.
That girl. Instead of running and hiding, the bitch girl was making telephone calls. Talk about brass-bound nerve. Her own idea? That was a little hard to believe, wasn't it?
What were you doing up and bustling in the kitchen so early?
I couldn't sleep.
She turned toward him, just a tall, elderly fellow with thinning hair and bifocals sitting at the end of his nose. A rube could pass him on the street every day for a year without seeing him, but he wasn't without certain abilities. Paul didn't have Snake's sleeper talent, or the late Grandpa Flick's locator talent, but he was a decent persuader. If he happened to suggest that a rube slap his wife's face, or a stranger's for that matter, that face would be slapped and briskly. Everyone in the true had their little skills. It was how they got along. Let me see your arms, Polly.
He sighed and brushed the sleeves of his robe and pajamas up to his wrinkly elbows. The red spots were there.
When did they break?
Saw the first couple yesterday afternoon.
Fever?
Yeah, some.
She gazed into his honest, trusting eyes and felt like hugging him. Some had run, but Long Paul was still here. So were most of the others. Surely enough to take care of the bitch girl if she were really foolish enough to show her face. And she might be. What girl of 13 wasn't foolish? You're going to be all right, she said. He sighed again.
Hope so. If not, it's been a damn good run.
None of that talk. Everyone who sticks is going to be all right. It's my promise, and I keep my promises. Now let's see what our little friend from New Hampshire has to say for herself.
3. Less than a minute after Rose settled into a chair next to the big plastic bingo drum with her cooling mug of coffee beside it, the lodge's pay telephone exploded with a 20th-century clatter that made her jump. She let it ring twice before lifting the receiver from the cradle and speaking in her most modulated voice.
Hello, dear. You could have reached out to my mind, you know. It would have saved you long-distance charges.
A thing the bitch girl would have been very unwise to try. Abra Stone wasn't the only one who could lay traps.
I'm coming for you,
the girl said.
The voice was so young, so fresh.
Rose thought of all the useful steam that would come with that freshness, and felt greed rise in her like an unslaked thirst.
So you've said. Are you sure you really want to do that, dear?
Will you be there if I do, or only your trained rats?
Rose felt a trill of anger. Not helpful, but of course she had never been much of a morning person.
Why would I not be, dear? She kept her voice calm and slightly indulgent, the voice of a mother, or so she imagined she had never been one, speaking to a tantrum-prone toddler.
Because you're a coward.
I'm curious to know what you base that assumption on, Rose said. Her tone was the same, indulgent, slightly amused. But her hand had tightened on the phone and pressed it harder against her ear.
Never having met me?
Sure I have. Inside my head. And I sent you running with your tail between your legs. And you kill kids. Only cowards kill kids.
You don't need to justify yourself to a child, she told herself, especially not a rube. But she heard herself saying, you know nothing about us, what we are, or what we have to do in order to survive.
A tribe of cowards is what you are, the bitch girl said. You think you're so talented and so strong, but the only thing you're really good at is eating and living long lives. You're like hyenas. You kill the weak and then run away. Cowards!
The contempt in her voice was like acid in Rose's ear.
That's not true. And you're the chief coward. You wouldn't come after me, would you? No, not you. You sent those others instead.
Are we going to have a reasonable conversation, or...
What's reasonable about killing kids so you can steal the stuff in their minds? What's reasonable about that, you cowardly old whore? You sent your friends to do your work. You hid behind them, and I guess that was smart, because now they're all dead.
You stupid little bitch, you don't know anything!
Rose leaped to her feet. Her thighs bumped the table and her coffee spilled running beneath the bingo drum. Long Paul peeked through the kitchen doorway, took one look at her face, and pulled back.
Who's the coward? Who's the real coward? You can say such things over the phone, but you could never say them looking into my face.
How many will you have with you when I come? Abra taunted. How many, you yellow bitch?
Rose said nothing. She had to get herself under control. She knew it. But to be talked to this way by a rube girl with a mouthful of filthy schoolyard language.
And she knew too much. Much too much.
Would you even dare to face me alone? The bitch girl asked.
Try me, Rose spat.
There was a pause on the other end, and when the bitch girl next spoke, she sounded thoughtful.
One-on-one? No, you wouldn't dare. A coward like you would never dare. Not even against a kid. You're a cheater and a liar.
You look pretty sometimes, but I've seen your real face. You're nothing but an old chicken shit whore.
You. But she could say no more. Her rage was so great it felt like it was strangling her. Some of it was shock at finding herself, Rose the Hat, dressed down by a kid whose idea of transportation was a bicycle and whose major concern before these last weeks had probably been when she might get breasts bigger than mosquito bumps.
But maybe I'll give you a chance, the bitch girl said. Her confidence and breezy temerity were unbelievable.
Of course, if you take me up on it, I'll wipe the floor with you. I won't bother with the others. They're dying already.
She actually laughed.
Choking on the baseball boy, and good for him.
If you come, I'll kill you, Rose said. One hand found her throat, closed on it, and began to squeeze rhythmically. Later there would be bruises. If you run, I'll find you. And when I do, you'll scream for hours before you die.
I won't run, the girl said, and we'll see who does the screaming.
How many will you have to back you up, dear?
I'll be alone.
I don't believe you.
Read my mind, the girl said. Are you afraid to do that too?
Rose said nothing.
Sure you are. You remember what happened last time you tried it? I gave you a taste of your own medicine, and you didn't like it, did you?
Hyena? Child killer? Coward?
Stop calling me that.
There's a place up the hill from where you are, a lookout. It's called Roof of the World. I found it on the internet. Be there at 5 o'clock Monday afternoon. Be there alone. If you're not, if the rest of your pack of hyenas doesn't stay in that meeting hall place while we do our business, I'll know. And I'll go away.
I'll find you, Rose repeated.
You think?
Actually jeering at her. Rose shut her eyes and saw the girl. She saw her writhing on the ground, her mouth stuffed with stinging hornets and hot sticks jutting out of her eyes.
No one talks to me like this. Not ever.
I suppose you might find me, but by the time you did, how many of your stinking true knot would be left to back you up? 10? Maybe only 3 or 4?
This idea had already occurred to Rose. For a child she'd never even seen face to face, to reach the same conclusion was, in many ways, the most infuriating thing of all.
"The crow knew Shakespeare," the bitch girl said. "He quoted some to me not too long before I killed him.
I know a little, too, because we had a Shakespeare unit in school. We only read one play, Romeo and Juliet, but Miss Franklin gave us a printout with a whole list of famous lines from his other plays. Things like, to be or not to be, and it was Greek to me. Did you know those were from Shakespeare? I didn't. Don't you think it's interesting?"
Rose said nothing.
"You're not thinking about Shakespeare at all," the bitch girl said. "You're thinking about how much you'd like to kill me. I don't have to read your mind to know that."
"If I were you, I'd run," Rose said thoughtfully. "As fast and as far as your baby legs can carry you. It won't do you any good, but you'd live a little longer."
The bitch girl was not to be turned.
"There was another saying. I can't remember it exactly, but it was something like, hoisted on your own petard. Miss Franklin said a petard was a bomb on a stick. I think that's sort of what's happening to your tribe of cowards. You sucked the wrong kind of steam and got stuck on a petard, and now the bomb is going off." She paused. "Are you still there, Rose? Or did you run away?"
"Come to me, dear," Rose said. She had regained her calm. "If you want to meet me on the lookout, that's where I'll be. We'll take in the view together, shall we? And see who's the stronger."
She hung up before the bitch girl could say anything else. She'd lost the temper she had vowed to keep, but she had at least gotten the last word. Or maybe not, because the one the bitch girl kept using played over and over in her head, like a gramophone record stuck in a bad groove. Coward. Coward. Coward.
4.
Abra replaced the telephone receiver carefully in its cradle. She looked at it. She even stroked its plastic surface, which was hot from her hand and wet with her sweat. Then before she realized it was going to happen, she burst into loud, braying sobs. They stormed through her, cramping her stomach and shaking her body. She rushed to the bathroom, still crying, knelt in front of the toilet and threw up. When she came out, Mr. Freeman was standing in the connecting doorway with his shirt tail hanging down and his gray hair in corkscrews.
"What's wrong? Are you sick from the dope he gave you?"
"It wasn't that."
He went to the window and peered out into the pressing fog.
"Is it them? Are they coming for us?"
Temporarily incapable of speech, she could only shake her head so vehemently her pigtails flew. It was she who was coming for them, and that was what terrified her. And not just for herself.
5.
Rose sat still, taking long, steadying breaths. When she had herself under control again, she called for Long Paul. After a moment or two, he poked his head cautiously through the swing door that gave on the kitchen. The look on his face brought a ghost of a smile to her lips.
"It's safe. You can come in. I won't bite you."
He stepped in and saw the spilled coffee.
"I'll clean that up."
"Leave it. Who's the best locator we've got left?"
"You, Rose."
No hesitation. Rose had no intention of approaching the bitch girl mentally, not even in a touch-and-go.
"Aside from me."
"Well, with Grandpa Flick gone, and Barry," he considered, "Sue's got a touch of locator, and so does Greedy G. But I think Token Charlie's got a bit more."
"Is he sick?"
"He wasn't yesterday."
"Send him to me. I'll wipe up the coffee while I'm waiting. Because this is important, Paulie. The person who makes the mess is the one who should have to clean it up.
After he left, Rose sat where she was for a while, fingers steepled under her chin. Clear thinking had returned, and with it the ability to plan. They wouldn't be